I'm Ralph Martiri. I'm Executive Director of the Bipartisan Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. We're not technically nonpartisan, we're bipartisan. That means my board of directors actually doesn't like or trust each other at all. And it's fantastic for us, the staff, because it lets us focus on best practices and data. So things have changed in Illinois in a very big way. I mean, when we all went to bed on August 30th, we went to bed in a state that actually had the worst school funding formula in America. And by worst, I mean the one that was the least equitable by every objective standard, and one that woefully inadequately funded K-12 education. By the time we went to bed the following evening, we went to bed in the state that had the best formula. It's not funded yet, but the actual formula that we have is going to work if we fund it, by definition, equitably, and it's going to ensure that every school district across the state has adequate resources to meet the needs of the kids it educates. So what changed? We used to be, like 36 other states, a foundation formula state, right? Where the state of Illinois would peg a foundation level amount of school funding per kid, and that would be the amount per kid statewide, and then some combination of state and local resources funded it. Our foundation level was based on nothing, not one actual objective cost of educating children. Not surprisingly, nothing is not the strongest predicate for education funding. So in the late 90s, Governor Edgar said, hey, I want to have an idea of what we should have this foundation level pegged to. So he appointed EFAB, the Education Funding Advisory Board. They made a recommendation for what that foundation level should be based on the cost of a very specific educational standard. What would it cost per kid to buy an education of sufficient quality to get two-thirds of the non-at-risk children passing our state's test? That was our old aspiration. Think about that as an aspiration. It's two-thirds of the non-at-risk kids, so it throws one-third of them out the window. Apparently, we don't care if they can pass tests. And it doesn't count any at-risk kids. So, you know, at-risk, term of art in education policy, it means at risk of academic failure. Three children hit that when they walk in the door, low-income, special needs, and English language learners. So apparently Illinois, up until the evidence-based model, didn't aspire to educate its at-risk kids. Even though that was a pretty tight, narrow standard, right, only getting to two-thirds of the children in the state who have a reasonable likelihood of academic success passing the state test, we never funded it. In fact, in 2017, last fiscal year, our state school funding in total was $4 billion less than what EFAB suggested. $4 billion. That's amazing. When the evidence-based model passed, it completely changed this foundation approach. No longer now going forward will the state set some capricious, arbitrary number of per-kid funding. Instead, the model identifies the resources, financial resources, every individual district in the state of Illinois needs based on its unique student population to implement those evidence-based practices which over time have demonstrated they actually enhance student achievement and across the board. So not just on test scores, they increase graduation rates, they reduce dropout rates, they increase college attendance rates, they increase college graduation rates. In other words, all those metrics that you really want, those outcome metrics you really want from a K-12 system, the evidence-based model funds. So there are 27 of these research or evidence-based elements built right into the statute. The State Board of Education has read it to be 34 elements, whatever. There's 27, but if ISBE wants to call it 34 for their ease, let's call it 34. And these practices include a lot of things that just make common sense, right? So it's smaller class size for K-3. Of course you need a smaller class size for K-3. It funds that. It funds high quality teachers. It funds high quality tier 2 interventionalists. It funds after-hours programs. It funds programs that are enrichment in nature, but we all know have a statistically meaningful correlation to enhancing student achievement. So let me give you an idea of how it works. Say you're in, I'm going to pick on a middle school district because I know those the best. I'm the president of a school board that's a elementary and middle school district. So say you have a middle school. Under the evidence-based model, it says, all right, for every 142 kids enrolled in your middle school, there's the first big change from the old formula, by the way. It's based on enrollment, not ADA. You have to create your school budget based on the number of kids enrolled to attend, not the number of kids who actually bothered to show up, by the way. So it's a nice positive change there. But for every 142 children enrolled in your school, the evidence-based model says you need one full-time equivalent teacher for every core subject, so it funds that. Then it says for every 125 low-income children, you need another full-time equivalent teacher in every core subject. And that low-income child counts twice, once in your general enrollment, and once again as a low-income kid. For every 125 English language learners, you need another full-time equivalent teacher in every core subject. And if that EL kid happens to be low income, that child counts three times. So you can see what the formula does. It takes these evidence-based practices, class size, interventionalists, professional development, nurses, guidance counselors, psychologists, based on your school district's unique student population, including its demographics. It says, here's the resources this district will need to implement these 27 evidence-based practices so that over time it's the children attending that district have a reasonable likelihood of academic success. They certainly will have the type of educational opportunity that will allow them to succeed as opposed to what we did in the past. So that's a big change. So every school district gets a unique, what's called adequacy target, the amount of resources it needs. That's the first part of the formula. Now, we don't have it fully funded. This may surprise no one. But when the State Board of Education ran the numbers, what they found was, based on the evidence, today school funding levels in Illinois are $7.4 billion short of what the evidence indicates is needed. And to ISBE's great credit, by the way, they requested that level of an increase for this coming year. They said, State, now that we know, let's put the money in, right? I thought that was a very rational thing to do. A number of commentators have slammed them for asking for this huge increase in school funding. It literally doubles what the state puts in. But the bottom line is it's the most rational request they could make. It's based entirely on the research and the evidence of what works. And since we know that, shouldn't we fund it? Interesting thing. We're not going to. Not right away. So they are going to put $350 million in new funding into the evidence-based model this year. And it looks like they're talking about putting a similar amount of new money in next year. So this is the only money, this $350 million, that is going to be distributed through the evidence-based model. How do you make sure that distribution goes to the schools that need it most? And what do you do about prior funding that school districts received? Well, the prior funding part we took care of was something called the base funding minimum. We changed over to the evidence-based model this year, fiscal year 2018. The base funding minimum for every school district in Illinois was what they received in state grants in 2017, all state grants. Now, this is going to create a little bit of a challenge for people tracking expenses, because included within that, right, are things like some old categorical funding for special education. That's still special education money. You still have to use that at the school district level for special education purposes. You still have to account for that. But that resource is wrapped into your base funding minimum so that the state can't take it away. What that really did was made it absolutely ironclad that shifting from our old flawed foundation formula to this new evidence-based model would not create winner and loser school districts. Because the printout politics of that would kill any education funding reform, right? Because legislators don't ask, is it a good policy proposal? They go, how does my school district do? And if their school district loses money, they are a no vote, no matter how good the legislation is. This took all that silly nonsense off the board. Plus, if you think about it, in a state that is $7.4 billion short of adequate as its starting point, let's not take resources away from schools, pre-existing resources. So that's the base funding minimum. The second part of what's expected to go into K-12 funding is some local resources. Now, this is not a surprise to everyone. Illinois is currently the most reliant state on local resources to fund K-12 education. We rely more on property taxes than any other state in America. However, you do have to have property taxes form a portion of your school funding. What the evidence-based model does for this element, it's called the local capacity target, is it looks at the EAD of every school district in the state of Illinois, and it puts them on a continuum. Based on where you are in the continuum, you're expected to put in a certain amount of school funding. So those school districts with very high levels of EAD are expected to put in a lot. Where I live, River Forest, we are expected to put in a lot. And communities in, let's say, East St. Louis, Marion, they're expected to put in significantly less because they have lower EAVs. That's the second element. So when you add those two elements together, your base funding minimum, what you got from the state, and your local capacity, what you rationally should be expected to put into school funding, that creates a dollar amount of current resources available between your local resources and what the state gave you last year to fund education. We divide that dollar amount by your adequacy target, the amount you should have, to see how close to adequate you are. Do you have 70% of the resources you need? 80, 90, 60? And based on that, this percentage of adequacy, every school district in the state of Illinois was put into one of four tiers. Tier 1 school districts are furthest away from adequacy. They have 64% of the resources the evidence indicates they need or less. Tier 2 school districts have between 64 and 90% of the resources. Tier 3, between 90 and 100. Tier 4, Tawny Little River Forest, 100% or more. So the new money now, the $350 million, is going to be distributed among these tiers as follows. Half of it goes to Tier 1. Half. $175 million of the $350 million goes to those districts that are furthest away from adequacy. The next 49% of the new money goes to Tier 1 and Tier 2 pro rata. So Tier 1 gets another bite at the apple. So now 99% of this new money have gone to districts that are below 90% of adequacy. 9/10 of 1% of the new money goes to those districts between 90 and 100% funded, and 1/10 of 1% of the new money goes to the river forests of the world. Now, why is the cutoff 90% of adequacy for, you know, really not getting much new money at all as opposed to 100%? And the answer is simple. The model is only considering state and local resources available to a school district. It is not looking at federal. Federal's not in the formula. So the federal government funds anywhere between 8 and 11% of the cost of education every year. So if you're at 90% of what the evidence indicates you need in your resources between your state and local mix, you're pretty close to 100%. And we really wanted to focus the distribution of new resources as they go into the formula on those districts furthest away from adequacy to bring them up most rapidly. Okay? So that is how the formula is designed and how it will work. Another interesting thing we did, that base funding minimum is not tied to 2017. It moves up every year. So whatever you get from the state of Illinois in the first year of the evidence-based model gets added into your old base funding minimum and becomes your new base funding minimum in 2019. We built in a fail-safe to stop the state from cutting pre-existing funding levels to schools. Those are the basic elements of the model. As you can tell, it's a very different approach to school funding than we've ever had before. Now, if you're curious about CPS, in the initial runs, and I haven't seen the final runs, I don't know if you've seen the final runs for CPS under the EBM, it was about $2.3 billion below adequate, just CPS. So CPS needs some resources to have an adequate amount of financial capacity to implement all these evidence-based practices for every school. And that's clear. You may have heard that the legislation constituted a bailout of the city of Chicago, and really, that rhetoric was not only inaccurate, I would say it was veiled racism, honestly. And it was used as politics to play mostly white and conservative areas of the state of Illinois against the city of Chicago. And frankly, against their own economic interests if they were low to middle income communities. And the reason I say that is we've actually looked at how the numbers were intended to go. Now, like I say, I haven't seen the final, so there'll be some minor adjustments. And CPS ends up getting roughly 20% of the new money under the distribution in the new formula, that evidence-based 350. They get about 70 million. They have 20% of the kids. Where's the disproportionate share going to CPS? I'm not seeing it. When you compare CPS's poverty profile and the number of kids they educate, so educates are about 367,000 kids attend CPS schools, and the poverty profile is roughly, the low income counts, roughly 85% of those children are low income. And you compare that to lumping together other school districts across the state that, as a combination, educate over 300,000 kids, and you look at their percentage of poverty, you find something very interesting. CPS ends up getting the same amount as school districts across the state that educate roughly 320,000 kids, so less than CPS, but have a poverty profile somewhere between 45 and 60% low income. So they have less concentration of poverty and fewer kids, but they get the same amount of money as CPS. Why would that be? The local capacity target. CPS, unlike other communities for the most part that have high concentrations of low-income children, has high EAV. It is expected to contribute some money in to the formula, and it should be. It's a rational thing to do when you're creating a statewide funding formula. But CPS's unique concerns, and particularly its unique concerns with its pension, were very well accounted for in the new formula. So the first thing we did, and this isn't news to anyone in the room, I don't think, is for the first time, the state's actually going to pay the normal cost contribution to the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. That's $220 million. So $220 million CPS used to have to take out of its property taxes to fund that pension contribution, just the normal cost part. It no longer has to. But think about that another way. That frees up $220 million CPS already has in its base funding minimum to use not for its old pension cost, but to put in the classroom. That's over and above the $70 million that's coming in. That's a nice addition. Now, it's not just normal cost, that is the cost of funding the benefit, that's the pension cost in CPS. I mean, as you all know, the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund, or I think you all know, was 100% funded in the year 2000. And then Mayor Daley and CPS decided to put $0 in for a decade. That creates an unfunded liability, you do it long enough, and 10 years is really pretty much long enough. So now the systems are just about 54% funded, meaning there's a huge legacy cost, an unfunded liability that has to be paid in addition to the normal cost. If the only issue with the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund was covering the normal cost, first of all, it's a very low normal cost, and it's very easily covered in extant resources. The add-on charge to CPS for engaging in this irresponsible fiscal practice for a decade this year is going to be roughly $490 million. So let's call it $500 million just to use a round number. Okay? What the model does is it says, look, that $500 million you have to pay. There's no way out of it. And the only place you're going to be able to pay it from CPS is your property taxes. So that $500 million reduces CPS's local capacity target. We understand that CPS can't spend the same tax dollar twice, once to pay its pension obligation and once to educate its children. So what we tried to do was create a funding formula that, I don't know, crazily enough reflected reality. So we tried to isolate only the property wealth resources CPS actually had available to it to fund the classroom. So that's a long and short way of saying the new formula, by design, will be equitable in distribution and adequate in amount. We just got to get it funded. So the challenges in a state like Illinois are generating adequate state-based resources to get the state to kick in this $7 billion, you know, sooner rather than later. And really, you wouldn't want to put it all in 1 year. So though ISB did make that request, if you think about it, a system can only rationally absorb so much of a new investment up front. It needs some time to plan for it. You have to do hiring. You have to do a facilities analysis, right? You have to deal with labor markets and availability and pipelines and all that stuff. So a better approach is actually phasing in that $7 billion, fully inflation adjusted, over a 3 to 5 year period. And probably five is better because it's a substantial amount of new money each year, and districts can plan thoughtfully over a 5 year cycle to take that money and incorporate it and use it. But we don't have it. I mean, the state of Illinois right now, in reality, has a deficit of north of $16 billion in a general fund that only spends about $27 billion on services. So that's a challenge. Now, they did borrow $6 billion to pay some of that backlog in bills, so the accumulated deficit will only look like it's $10 billion. It's actually the $6 billion. So the state needs to raise some new resources, but I think it's really going to be an easier political path to put pressure on the General Assembly and whomever the governor is to raise those resources now that we've passed the evidence-based model. Because we can say something now as advocates for education we could never say before. We know what it costs to educate our children, and you're not putting it in. This isn't all about the poor, starving kids. This is about what the research says is needed to fund an educational system that meets the educational needs of the children it serves. And by meeting their needs, we're saying putting in those practices that have been shown to improve student achievement over time. Isn't that what you want out of an education system? So I don't want to hear the education governor or the education legislator or the education anything unless you're willing to talk about raising the revenue we need to fund our schools to what the evidence indicates is required. Different argument, isn't it? The second thing that's really neat about the evidence-based model, we were having a little sidebar about this, but it creates an advocacy tool for parents, stakeholders. Why do I say that? The statute lays out what the evidence-based practices are. You can now look at how your school district is spending its resources and see if it's allocating them the way the research indicates actually enhances student achievement. And, you know, it might be a challenge, given contracts and everything else, to move around base funding minimum, the old money, into these new evidence-based categories, right? But as the new money comes in, I want, at least my school district is talking about, how do we apply our money to maximize the effect size, what the research indicates works, to move student achievement? You now know that. We know the effect size for these practices. Some of the most powerful things school districts can do with money, because you can't put all these things in place at once. The state's not funding the full evidence-based model. You have to pick and choose. Low-cost, high outcomes come from high-end, embedded, evidence-based professional development for your teachers. Tier 2 interventionalists. Let's get them on board. Let's start there. That's a way to build the capacity of the system. But anyway, it's a very radical change, the evidence-based model, and how we fund education, but it's a really, really good one. It's literally the best practice now any state has on its books. And it's up to us as advocates to make sure it gets funded. Thank you.